Great. Okay. If you can keep your questions brief and identify yourself, I'll collect the three hands in the back that I see up. So starting here with this gentleman. Yes, you.
Hi, Doug Robinson, Australian grad student at the size of the road. Rory, just wondering about the South Pacific issue. You said there'll be plenty more in that space from China onwards to that effect in the next year. We've seen Australia come back on both Vanuatu and Fiji. Mm. When you consider the relative economic size differences, we're not just going to be able to keep, you know, outbidding China, so to speak. So how do you think this plays out in the South Pacific in coming years?
Great.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You. Gil Rosman of the ASEAN Forum. Australia has been a leader in raising these issues. John Garneau, John Fitzgerald, and others. You talked about it as a bellwether. You talked about the influence of the U.S. problems with Russia on Australia. To what extent do you see Australian academics, including yourself, leading in a kind of concerted international response to how to deal with this, what is called sharp power?
Yeah.
Can we bring Japan heavily into this because of the Australia-Japan ties? In other words, do you see an opportunity now coming to Washington to sort of lead an intellectual response that will be supplement the government response?
Now, I saw a question in the back. Miss?
Hi, Glenn Johnson, Senator of American Progress. Given what you said about what Australia values about the rule of law and the way that China is applying some of the techniques that you describe at the level of international institutions to undermine consensus-based decision-making and other community sovereignty, what is Australia's perspective about the battlefield on that level and what Australia can or would like to be there?
Great. So I'll take this through. Yeah, okay. I can take follow-ups if you want. Three's plenty. They're all rich questions there. Okay, so Dougal, we'll start with you, South Pacific, and what's next. Look, what I was alluding to there, among other things, is we should all be watching for the spectacle in November this year when APEC is held in Port Moresby. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing for APEC to be held somewhere like Port Moresby, and there'll be some, from a logistic point of view, who'll be relieved that President Trump is not going. But I think from an American signaling point of view, it's obviously not so good for the president not to be there. The big story, though, will be what Xi Jinping does. The big story will be that, you know, I anticipate this will be a grand debut for China in the South Pacific. I think there will be major investment and infrastructure, largesse and bounty that is brought to that dialogue. And that really Australia will find, and others will find, that increasingly we're competing very directly for China, with China for influence in PNG. And it's worth bearing in mind, as I've had to remind folks from time to time, that, you know, you can get from PNG to Australia by canoe. This is our nearest neighbour. It's very, very close. And so everything that happens in PNG is of acute interest to Australia's security and interests. Having said that, look, of course, China has a right to be involved in the South Pacific. Of course, everyone needs infrastructure, it seems these days, and China has infrastructure to offer. So we're also going to have to find ways of working with China in the South Pacific. And I think the new dynamic that we'll see is not simply Australia versus China in the South Pacific. It will be Australia and others. I'm looking at the United States, I'm looking at Japan, I'm looking at Europe and others to find new multilateral and minilateral ways of helping South Pacific states get the development, their development needs met, while also trying to offset the security risks, because it is a staple of Australian defence policy since the 1940s that we do not want a major power with the potential future interest in perhaps contesting Australian influence to have a military presence in the South Pacific. So this is pretty serious stuff from an Australian perspective. Gil, nice to see you. Nice to meet you in person.
Me too.
Your point about Australian academics, look, I wouldn't overplay that. I mean, I think there are a number of Australian academics, journalists, maybe pracademics might be a better way to describe a few of us, academics who are, you know, quite engaged in the policy debate, who have been very forthright on this issue, and I think have played a role in raising international attention on this issue.
But I think what strikes me now is how quickly this has gone from being an Australian story from, you know, the middle of last year, the year before. I mean, the middle of last year, I was, you know, actually, I kind of missed my chance to copyright it, but I was using terms like sharp power and newspaper articles 6 months later on the front page of The Economist. So, you know, it's so quick to see this issue become a global issue. And, of course, the Russia-US thing, I guess, is much more immediate and much more consequential to the US in the short term. But I'm struck by the conversations I have in places like Germany, France, Singapore, Japan, Vietnam. You know, it's a long list of countries that are suddenly looking much more closely at this issue. I think the, rather than kind of Australian proselytising, what I'd like to see is much more concerted international coordination on these issues, whether it's at a track two, track one and a half level, you know, the D10 initiative, for example, whether it's among civil society players right across the democratic world, so that really this becomes a kind of an issue of resilience and solidarity, and a not strictly an anti-China issue, but an issue of these societies really standing up for their own interests. And I do think over the next year or two, let's watch what happens in the academic space, because academics themselves are now becoming, thankfully, more self-reflective on this issue, including the issue of self-censorship. And finally, Green, I think it was, on the rule of law up the back and lawfare and so forth. I think Australia's been fairly forthright, and I think fascinatingly, when Australia talks, for example, about UNCLOS or international law more generally, we've taken steps in recent years to iron out some of the contradictions, or you could say, you know, latent hypocrisy in our own position on certain issues, such as our border delimitation, maritime delimitation with East Timor. So I think Australia has pretty clean hands on this issue, and I think we'll continue to be fairly forthright in partnership with others. I think in the South China Sea, for example, although we, you know, many of us who watch these issues have been disappointed with the way, you know, the Philippines, under its current leadership, has not owned the extraordinary decision, or, you know, the rather strong decision that it got out of the Court of Arbitration in recent years. The issue's not over. I think in many ways that decision is the property of the international community. So I think you will see Australia and a range of other countries continue to keep some of these issues alive. That's not fair.
I can take another range. Start with Deepa.
Thank you for, again, a fascinating presentation. As you mentioned Indo-Pacific many times, and as we know, the Chinese do not use that term because they see that as a kind of a challenge to their view of the region. And so that itself is problematic. And I'd be interested to see how Australia, which is a very big promoter of that, how it engages with China in the dialogues on this. And that brings me to the point on South Pacific, where in the past, the Australians have not been very, very concerned about the Chinese version of the Indo-Pacific. That's a maritime Silk Road.
Yeah.
And so do you see, and in the past, again, have not been particularly supportive of the Quad idea, mm-hmm. quadrilateral with US, Australia, Japan, and India. Has that, do you see a shift in that now, given your emerging concerns on the maritime region in the South Pacific? A specific question, but then I have a bigger question, and that is, if you think of the emerging order in Asia as perhaps one where the Chinese, with the Belt and Road Initiative particularly and the ambitions, getting dominance along the land route in the Central Asia, Eurasia, whereas and the other one being the Indo-Pacific maritime regions, where the United States continues to have a dominance, is that in your mind a stable balance of power in the Indo, in the Asian order? Sorry, I had to ask.
Wow, questions. We've got time. That's great.
It's Jennifer Zhang from the Epoch Times. Yeah. I remember back in 2005. And a very high-profile Chinese diplomat, Mr. Chen Yongming, defected to Australia. He made some very shocking allegations, like there were 1,000 Chinese spies in Australia, and Chinese Communist Party's overall strategy of turning Australia into a kind of colony-like country, a border country for the China and to pull Australia away from US. At that time, I think not many attention was paid to his allegations. So what is the most important factors that make Australia society seem to be suddenly aware of these problems? And is it too late to respond to some of these issues, and what the US can learn from Australian experiences? Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there another question to round out?
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. That's fine, because Deb, you had four questions there.
I'm sorry about that.
I think at least four. They're all good. Okay, so lots of good questions. Look, I'll actually start with your question, and then I'll move backwards to allow time for Deepa's menu of questions. So, look, I guess in many ways, I've tried in my remarks to answer your question already. I mean, I think I've tried to give a sense of the, you know, the accumulation of media reporting, and also, although obviously, you know, there are things that I don't know, things I can't say, the accumulation of the intelligence side of it as well. So I think there's been enough there gradually building awareness in the political class that Australia has woken up. And I certainly don't take the view that it's too late. I mean, I think there are some, I think there's even a line in Clive Hamilton's book that suggests it's too late. I mean, you know, these are incredibly subjective points to make. You know, I think the bipartisanship behind the laws that we saw this year, I think, was a very reassuring sign that it's not too late. The challenge now will be, how do we play the next steps? And as I said in my remarks, what can the US learn? And I think the US and other countries need to understand the Australian experience in context so that we don't see a kind of crude or potentially xenophobic response to any of these issues anywhere. But instead, if Australia can get this right with a very large and diverse Chinese community in our midst, in our multicultural society, then other democracies should be able to do the same thing. And Australians are not always known for our finesse. So, you know, I think if we can get this right, then we're doing well. On, Deepa, your four questions, the big one, well, actually the biggest one is about the stable balance. I mean, I'll struggle with that. I mean, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but let's work through it sequentially. Australia-China relations in the context of the Indo-Pacific, and I think one of the big, and I could, you know, give you another whole hour on the Indo-Pacific, but mercifully I don't have time. One of the big, I think, misperceptions about the Indo-Pacific is that it's about India. I think the Indo-Pacific is about China, and I, by that, I mean that it's the extension of China's interests and China's presence across the Indo-Pacific, across the Indian Ocean, South Asia, to Africa, the South Pacific now, etc., that has driven more than anything else this new regional construct. In fact, China may not like the term, but at this stage China is the only country with an Indo-Pacific strategy. It's just that it calls it the Maritime Silk Road. So in that sense, we're arguing about semantics in many ways rather than about reality. What China, in my sense, doesn't like about the Indo-Pacific idea or the variants of the Indo-Pacific idea that Australia, Japan, India, Indonesia, the United States, France, and a whole bunch of other countries are now beginning to experiment with is that it is multipolar, it is not China-centric, it is about including, incorporating, but diluting Chinese power in a much larger regional framework. So it won't be a China-centric order. And I think that is still an attainable outcome, and we hope, I certainly hope, that it is an outcome that in time China can come to terms with, if you like, without something resembling conflict. So I don't think it matters whether Australia and China have semantic arguments about terminology. I think what's fascinating is to see that, for example, a lot of Southeast Asia is now developing its own version of the Indo-Pacific, and that proves that this is not just Donald Trump's idea, and it's not an American plot. This is a reflection of a multipolar region that China has to come to terms with. The South Pacific component of that, I guess for Australia, again, I really only reiterate a lot of the things I've said already. You know, we've suddenly, I guess belatedly, come to realise that China, I believe, does have strategic and geoeconomic objectives in the South Pacific, and that Australia can no longer have things all its own way in the South Pacific. And the response to that needs to be this kind of inclusive, multilateral response that I've referred to. The quadrilateral, incidentally, the South Pacific is not a neat fit in the whole Belt and Road construct. I mean, it's kind of a
a byway. So it kind of, it reinforces the view that this is simply not about delivering connectivity for the good of all. China, I think, has a range of other objectives in the South Pacific. The Quad, look, not a lot to say. I mean, I think as someone who's sort of been mildly positive about the Quad as, I think, a useful piece of the diplomatic toolkit of the region, by the same token, we should not invest it with magical properties. We should not somehow see this as the solution to the whole power balancing game in the region. The Quad is one element in a multi-layered puzzle, and I think the Quad is not a military alliance in being, but nor is it a dialogue that another country has the right to veto. So I think let's just treat the Quad as a piece of the puzzle. I'm actually more interested in many ways in a lot of the trilaterals that are forming, because trilaterals tend to have a lot, three legs often have a lot more strength than four. So, you know, Australia, Japan, US, India, Japan, US, for example, India, Japan, Australia, there's a whole lot of interesting other relationships that are growing up. Finally, the big question about, if China dominates the continental and the maritime democracies dominate the maritime, what does that mean for the balance? I don't think that's going to happen. So I guess my way out is to say that the belt doesn't work without the road, because if you look at key pieces of Belt and Road infrastructure, if they have strategic or geoeconomic benefits for China, they're about connecting the land with the sea. They're about, you know, Pakistan or Myanmar or Malaysia or elsewhere. If it's just about China throwing enormous resources into overland connectivity with Eurasia and Europe, look, great. You know, in many senses, as far as strategic purposes are concerned, I think that is that is going to be money poorly spent. The fact remains that energy and goods will continue to be much more economically transported by sea for at least decades to come. China's going to have to engage as a player in the maritime space, and it's doing that. And of course, the fact that China is focusing so heavily on naval modernisation suggests to me, and the aircraft carriers are not for the South China Sea, they're much further afield. So that suggests to me that China is turning to the sea, rightly or wrongly, and we need to encourage China to do that, not in a unilateral way.
We have time for one or two more questions. Why don't I take these two as our last two? So. Go ahead.
From Hamilton, as an undergrad at the George Washington University. You talked about how the will inside of Australia to rebalance or reform the relationship with China is more born out of considerations for domestic politics. But my question is, as or if the U.S.-China strategic competition heightens, how likely do you think it is that the U.S. will push China to become more adversarial in their relationship with China, push Australia to be more adversarial in their relationship with China, and how do you think Australians will react to that in terms of their desire to project their own sovereign foreign policy?
Yes.
Yeah, just in the last few months, U.S. House and the Senate, both Senator and the House Congressman also introduced a bill to counter Chinese government and the CCP's political influence. They asked to do a cross-agency evaluation, it's kind of a report to evaluate the political influence of the CCP in this country. So I don't know whether in Australia you have similar evaluation report, or are you considering to do something like that? And also in the NDAA passed just recently in the United States, it included the reform of the CFIRS, which is about the foreign investment to prevent China from getting the high-tech technology from United States by direct investment. So I don't know whether in Australia you have similar legislation on this aspect. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, just two. All right. I'll start with yours first, actually, and then I'll still be able to remember the other one, I hope. Sorry, I didn't get your name.
Katie Wong with NTDTV.
Okay, thanks. So, look, what are the Australian analogies to those two processes you've mentioned? Look, it's fair to say, and I've mentioned it in my remarks, and it's a matter of public record in the Australian media, that there was a classified report done for the Australian government between late 2016 and early 2017 that was a cross-agency report. So in a sense, Australia's already done that piece of homework on this issue, and I think that informed, among many other factors, that was one of the factors informing the activity that Australia took. So again, I'd like to think Australia is ahead of the United States on that issue. Secondly, in terms of foreign investment, so Australia has what's called a Foreign Investment Review Board. And for many years, it's fair to say that security wasn't uppermost in their considerations. In fact, it's false, as some observers have suggested. It's inaccurate to say that the Australian Foreign Investment Review Board, you know, frequently rejects Chinese investment. In fact, it very, very rarely rejects Chinese investment in Australia. But what's happened on a very small number of instances in recent years is that new guidelines that integrate security considerations into its decision making have been deployed, and in particular with the appointment of former senior Australian intelligence leader David Irvin as chair of the board, I guess that both in the public eye and in the reality started creating the perception that security is becoming a much bigger consideration for them. I'll move to, I think, your point about domestic politics in Australia and the US-Australia relationship. So I'll just clarify, I think you said domestic politics, and I'll just re-emphasise that it's not as if, you know, electoral politics was a motivator in any of this. And I think it's, again, one of the myths that I didn't add to my list of seven, thankfully, is that somehow Australian political parties think, you know, there are lots of votes to be won if you start being rude to China. I think, you know, that is not the case. So I think in many ways, Prime Minister Turnbull, who came from a business background and a background where I think he was pretty personally sympathetic to a relatively accommodationist view of China when he came into office, began to realise over time that it was not so easy to do that, and that there were national sovereignty considerations at work. So I think it's been domestic sovereignty that's driven so much of the Australian debate. Now that goes to the second half of your question. You know, if the US gets more adversarial with China, will the US push Australia into places where we don't want to go? And that is, again, that's already a pretty widely alleged dynamic in the relationship. I think, you know, every few months you see an article saying US tells Australia to do a FONOP, and Australia says no. It never actually works like that. And I think, I don't think it will continue to work like that. I think if we get to a point where the United States is pushing hard for Australia to take security measures against China that are not in our interest, that there will have been wider conversations in the relationship well and truly before then that will, I guess, preempt those tensions. I do think that Australia will continue to play a role, and I think Australia plays a kind of a classic moderating role in the alliance. So on the one hand, I'd say 2 or 3 years ago, even a year ago, we probably had American friends in this town who were saying to Australia, why are you so worried about this China thing? Sure, you've got bigger things, other things to worry about than, you know, alleged Chinese political activity in Australia. Now the US system has, I think, quite fundamentally been, I guess, woken up on this issue, including by its Australian friends. It could well be that our job now becomes almost the opposite, to try and moderate the debate in this country and elsewhere, to emphasise the things that I've said today, that, you know, defending your interests against China is not the same as confronting China. And so I think my sense is that Australia will be looking for America to tread a middle line in its engagement in the Indo-Pacific, to make sure that it is not unilaterally confronting China, but that it is working in solidarity with other democracies, and also recognising that we don't want to, you know, we certainly don't want a containment-led future. We want a future of engagement plus much more serious balancing than perhaps we've seen in the past. So does that help? Yeah, thank you.
Well, I'm conscious that Professor Metcalf has a very long journey ahead of him, and he's catching a flight this evening back to Australia. Thank you very much for a very rich and enjoyable conversation. I'm sure if you have an individual question, you can catch him afterwards, but please help me in thanking Professor Metcalf.
Thank you.